This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and in a bellwether for the environment, there is a report today that New York is testing the waters, literally, on allowing fracking in certain parts of certain counties throughout New York State. We'll be speaking live with Kate Hudson of the Riverkeeper Organization about what that might mean for the environment and the water table. Also today, we'll be looking at the Senate Banking Committee hearings on J.P. Morgan Chase, and what happened to all the money, and why is there so much retrenchment in the public sector? All of that and more coming up on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and New York State is tempting what environmentalists are calling a dangerous policy of a selective allowance of fracking throughout New York State. The New York Times is reporting that Governor Andrew Cuomo is contemplating a tiptoe into the tulips of fracking, of hydrofracking. And we're now joined by Kate Hudson of the Riverkeeper Organization. And Kate, you said that the governor may be willing to gamble with the health, environment, and safety of thousands of New Yorkers. First of all, what do we know?
Well, the first thing I want to emphasize is that this was this article was based on a press leak, and Riverkeeper, and I don't think anybody else actually, has seen an actual document. So this is not an official proposal. And so any comments I make about it are really based on the speculation that is in the New York Times article. Having said that, it would appear that what the article is reporting on is a Cuomo administration plan to allow hydrofracking to move forward in a number of counties in the southern tier. On a trial or limited basis. The limits would be on where it happens. And we have a number of concerns about that. Basically, the plan is to allow it to go forward in areas where the towns have indicated that they want it. And among other things, the idea that these towns have enough information to be able to make an informed decision about that is really questionable because of all the flaws and gaps that are currently in the SGIS or environmental review that the state has done. There has not been a hard look at socioeconomic costs. There's not been any look at health costs. There has been no plan as to how the millions of gallons of wastewater are going to be handled. And with the absence of that information, it sounds like this plan would require towns to indicate whether or not they thought they wanted to go forward with hydrofracking, which we think is unreasonable.
If the alleged proposal is under contemplation as it is reported to be stated, does that open up vulnerability that local communities can be convinced into permission for hydrofracking through publicity and promises of economic boons that will be presented by the industry in such a situation?
Well, I think we are all very familiar with the PR campaign that the gas industry has been waging already and the amount of money in the millions of dollars that they have put towards lobbying the legislature and other elected officials. And so there is clearly a huge risk that the focus of that lobbying and information campaign could be focused on small municipalities with very few resources and the individuals that live in those towns, and that could result in decisions being made that after the fact, the citizens of those towns may live to regret. One of the things that I think is very interesting is that this plan was issued in the wake of the recently released Cornell poll which looked at the waning support for hydrofracking in upstate communities. And what it indicated is the more that upstate communities learn about hydrofracking, the less interested they are in seeing it go forward. So again, this is almost like a race against time to get communities to indicate they want to move forward before they have all the facts, because if they have all the facts, they may decide that they don't want to.
It seems to me that water tables, rivers, residue, waste, gases, and so on do not necessarily honor municipal or statewide borderlines. And it may seem that we're speaking about a few counties in New York State, but isn't there a very intimate interrelationship between the nearby states like Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania that have mutual interests in maintaining the purity of the water system?
That is absolutely the case, that water and air do not respect political boundaries. And I don't even think we have to go as far as looking to adjacent states to find communities and individuals that will be impacted who have not consented to having this activity in their neighborhood, adjacent towns to the ones that say they do want to go forward to hydrofracking, are absolutely going to be impacted, whether it is by water contamination issues, air contamination issues, or traffic. And the toll that you know, 4,000 truck trips per well will take on local roads. And those trucks aren't stopping at the town line of the towns that have said, yes, we want fracking. They're going to be driving through the towns that said, no, we do not want it. So it was actually very concerning to us that they are looking at least five counties. That covers a huge amount of the southern tier and opens up many communities that do not want fracking to the impacts associated with it in any case.
In other words, communities can be affected with the ill health and environmental consequences of what we might call second-hand frack.
Yes, certainly involuntarily impacted.
Well, what has been the response of nearby states? I understand that there may be a different approach in Pennsylvania than in New York.
Well, certainly Pennsylvania enthusiastically opened their doors to the gas industry. In fact, before they really were ready for them and before they had the regulations and the regulatory staff to monitor the activity. And we have seen what a disaster that has been. In fact, one of the thoughts that Riverkeeper and others have had is, why do we need a demonstration project in New York when we have a demonstration project going on next door in Pennsylvania showing us all the ways in which hydrofracking can adversely impact communities from an environmental perspective, community perspective, a health perspective. And Pennsylvania has embarked on a course of action that has really injured many communities within its borders. New Jersey, on the other hand, has banned hydrofracking. So there are, and as has Vermont, so there are other actions that other states are taking. By the way, the New Jersey ban was passed by the legislature but was vetoed by the governor.
Can you take us further across the country in the central and western states? What is the perspective there?
Well, I think that there is growing opposition as the significance of the impacts, the linking of the hydrofracking activities to impacts and the significance of those impacts are becoming more broadly known. Hydrofracking has been going on for longer and by the way, I should say hydrofracking, when I use the term hydrofracking and fracking, I'm really referring to the entire series of activities that are involved in extracting unconventional gas from tight shale plays. And so we're talking about everything from clearing sites, chopping down trees and putting in roads, to piping it to the end user. And we're not talking about just that particular action that's called hydrofracking that happens when they explode millions of gallons of water and chemicals underneath the ground. But hydrofracking has been going on longer in Texas and Wyoming and Colorado. As a result, it is actually very instructive for us to look at what has happened in those areas and see what kinds of impacts we've had. And we've seen air impacts in Colorado and Wyoming. We've seen groundwater impacts in Pavilion, Wyoming. And so they should be cautionary tales for New York. But again, I think that New York State has said that it has put together the strictest regulations in the country. Riverkeeper and NRDC and Earth Justice, in reviewing those regulations, compared them to other regulations across the country, and they are, in fact, not as strict as many states are. Setbacks from homes and schools is a perfect example. And so we do not believe New York has put together a regime, a regulatory regime, or even has the capacity. If they had the regulatory regime that was the strictest in the country, which we don't think they do, to enforce that regulatory regime, to be able to allow hydrofracking to move forward.
Remaining on the national track here, does the Environmental Protection Agency have any input into this process of what the administration is welcoming as a new energy production technique?
The Environmental Protection Agency has had its hands tied fairly significantly by the Halliburton loophole.
The what?
Halliburton loophole is what is known as. That was enacted into law in the 2005 Energy Act, and this was a Dick Cheney negotiated behind closed doors with the energy industry. And basically, it exempts oil and gas activities, which include hydrofracking, from at least half a dozen environmental laws, including the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, RCRA, and several others. And because they are exempt, it means that EPA doesn't have any regulatory jurisdiction over a lot of what is going on here. And that was very calculated by the energy industry. They would rather see this regulation fall to the states, many of which are completely unprepared to do that regulation. So it gives the industry a freer hand. But I think that there are some steps that EPA is taking. For instance, they have promulgated new air regulations that unfortunately the industry persuaded them to delay the implementation of for several years, but that would limit and reduce the emissions from hydrofracking operations significantly. And these are the emissions that are ozone precursors cause basically or contribute to respiratory diseases, particularly in the young and the elderly. We are gratified that those regulations were promulgated. We are very discouraged that their effective date was put off. It's another 2 years that we're going to be dealing with the air emissions problem.
This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're speaking with Kate Hudson, the Watershed Program Director of Riverkeeper. And the exquisite complexity and chemical risk of the extraction of oil and gas from deep rock under the hydrofracking regime is something that I think is important for as many people to understand on an intimate level rather than just saying, well, they're just drilling for oil. Can you give us the anatomy of a grime? Can you describe the process?
I can certainly describe the process, although I have to say that a visual is a much better way of describing the process. But I would like to take one step back and say the reason why the oil and gas industry is having to use these extremely destructive measures to get oil and gas out of the ground is because all of the easily accessible fossil fuels have already been extracted. And because we are still, as a nation and as a world, unwilling to walk away from our addiction to fossil fuels, we're now engaged in a much more destructive process to get at what is left. When this involves natural gas, it used to be the case that you could drill down several hundred feet and then you would hit a pocket of natural gas, a big, significant pocket, and then just suck the gas up. But that was also true of oil. That oil and gas is no longer available, and so now what is being extracted is little bubbles of gas that are trapped in rock formations and distributed, you know, very thinly through those rock formations. So in order to be able to make this financially sensible at all, economically extractable, what companies are doing is they're drilling down a mile, 5,000 feet or more, into tight shale formations known as, for instance, the Marcellus Shale here in the Northeast, and then drilling horizontally for up to several miles. I think they can drill up to 5 miles, and then forcing millions of gallons of water and chemicals and sand down into that horizontal pipe and exploding that into the shale, which then shatters the shale and props it open and releases the gas, which then comes back up the pipe along with a good portion of the fracking fluids, those are the chemicals and water, as well as what is called production fluids. It basically what is happening is that there are fluids and substances that have lived down below since prehistoric times that are being mobilized by the fracking operation. And this includes radioactive materials, heavy metals, and brine, which is just incredibly salty water. And the industry in New York has no plan for how to dispose of those millions of gallons of fracking fluid and mobilized production fluid. They have none. What's happening with it in Pennsylvania is they first tried to put it through sewage treatment plants that didn't have the capability of processing that, and it ended up contaminating some water bodies in Pennsylvania that were the sources of drinking water. So now it all gets trucked to Ohio, where it is injected underground and has been linked to triggering earthquakes.
So it's a great big straw, a lot of water, chemicals to try and bring out tiny pockets of gas. What happens to all that dirty water?
That's what I was referring to in saying that they don't have a plan for it.
Yeah.
There is no sewage treatment plant in New York standing here today that has the ability to process that wastewater. And there are no underground injection wells in New York, which there are in Ohio, that would be an alternative to disposal. And so there is no plan for disposing of that wastewater other than the idea that some of that brine that got mobilized, which may be radioactive, could be spread on local roads as a de-icer. It is a possibility that's left open in SGEIS, the environmental review that DEC did.
You made an interesting point about the increasing cost of the extraction of fossil fuels. Does this tie in with what people call the peak oil syndrome?
I would call it the end of oil syndrome. it is an interesting point because what many in the industry and even, unfortunately, in our political world would argue that this discovery that we have, this unconventional oil and gas available within our borders, is actually a wonderful thing. And it will allow us to have energy independence at a cost, at a cost to communities and certain areas within the country. But somebody is going to be making a buck. This is actually, if you look at it closely, it's a false assumption because we are going to run out of that oil and gas at some point, and there are varying estimates. But depending on who you speak to about the amount of gas in the Marcellus Shale at current rates, it could be used up at 20 years or 30 years. And do we really want to tear up our community and our environment for that? The other thing that it's doing is, because natural gas is so cheap right now, it is undercutting the development of renewables, of green energy. They are not able to compete, and so it is slowing their development, which means when we do run out of the oil and gas, we are really going to be in trouble because our ability to access renewable energy and the technology that we need to be able to do that will not have moved forward as much as it needs to.
Kate Hudson is Riverkeepers Watershed Program Director, and I really appreciate your taking the time to renew in some detail the consequences of hydrofracking and its potential imminence in the Northeast, in New York State, and elsewhere across the country. And I give you this moment to explain to people what you do at riverkeeper.org and how they may become involved and perhaps even alter the fate of their local communities.
Well, I would encourage anyone who is interested in this to visit our website. We send out regular action alerts and information about actions that people can take in terms of contacting their legislators or the governor, writing letters, et cetera. And it couldn't be more important. We are at a turning point in one of the largest environmental issues that New York State has faced in decades. And the governor is listening, and if people speak, it could make the difference. And so I encourage everybody who is concerned about this to speak out in whatever way makes sense for them.
Well, thank you. Kate Hudson, the Watershed Program Director of Riverkeeper.org. And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there are stories that are not apocryphal about faucets flaming up as a result of gas blowback from the fracking process. This is My Water is on Fire Tonight, the fracking song.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights, and the drill is making killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground, the pressure cranks, pushes 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town, that will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow, with names like benzene and formaldehyde. You better keep them far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below, the groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the rest. Residents of Sublet Way, oh, that water's frack. We're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
So it all goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was frack until the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was in the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Sick people couldn't prove fracking was to blame, all the while water wells were going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane release. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong, things like climate change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reduce the toxins contain the gas and wastewater, and the people will get sick, and the planet will get hotter.
What the frack is going on? With all this fracking going on, I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
Don't go near the water. Don't you think it's sad? What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on land. Don't go near the water. Ain't it safe?
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and we just heard My Water is on Fire Tonight, a fracking song with music by David Holmes and Andrew Bean, and lyrics and vocals by Holmes and Neil Becker. Also, the Beach Boys, Don't Go Near the Water. There are hearings in Washington, D.C. on the banking and financial industry. The Senate Banking Committee held hearings with representatives from J.P. Morgan Chase. And we're now joined live by Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston and a senior fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. And let's just begin. Welcome to the 5 O'Clock Shadow. And what's been going on in Washington today, Thomas?
Hi there. Well, okay. I don't want anyone to think that I'm making this up or contaminating it with my judgment, but I'm looking at MSNBC.com, and I see the headline is Senate Treats J.P. Morgan CEO Dimon with Kid Gloves. And I think, you know, look, how much more abject, you know, when MSNBC begins to sound like WBAI, you know that things are really crazy. And they are. They're perverse. I mean, look, this is another one of these deals where effectively we've had a kind of fake investigation. I don't think anything has really been clarified. And I mean, not everybody disgraced themselves. I mean, Senator Merkley, I thought was pretty good. So was Cole. But and there might be one or two others. I will simply pass over the New York Senator Schumer, who was there. Let me just dip around that. I didn't actually see the hearings. What I heard on the written record here is not overwhelming. Anyway, they obviously gave this guy a very easy time. And an unsympathetic being like myself would note that, well, what a surprise. Senator Tim Johnson, the chairman of the Banking Committee, who was there, his largest contributor is J.P. Morgan Chase, and indeed virtually every member of the banking committee has altogether too much money from banking. So, and I wasn't expecting much there, and I think these folks on the whole delivered even less. Now, if you'd like, I can tick off a few things they should have done. The first thing they should have done was to nail down the nature of that trade, because it's just ridiculous after the trades that lost all the money. Because it's just ridiculous that after all these weeks, we have to listen to any arguments about whether the Volcker Rule would or would not have prevented them. I mean, that should have been nailed down before he testified. And obviously the staff, you know, I don't know what the staff recommended, but the senators as a group defaulted. Then I think people should have asked, like we've been told, that all of the American banking entities are safe if there's a problem with Europe. And, you know, we are clearly heading over the cliff in Europe. Whether or not the Eurozone breaks down after the Greek election is an open question. But that tells you how crazy things are getting. And we've been told we don't have to worry. These folks have hedged fine. We've been told that by regulators and by bankers. Now, I think we've all discovered that assurances about hedges aren't worth very much. And so, you know, that should lead immediately to questions about, well, okay, what's the exact state of the American large banking system? One is tempted to say the too big to fail banks right now. As far as I can tell, that didn't come up. There are other questions. You know, I wrote a piece on AlderNet yesterday that talked about the fact that many banks, J.P. Morgan Chase included, sold a load of swap agreements to American cities and school boards and states, that including a fair number of transit companies, on which those the people that signed the deals with them have lost enormous sums. And they're refusing to let those entities out except by paying enormous fees. New York City alone, according to the study by the transit group that I was quoting in that AlderNet piece, is losing over $100 million annually on these deals. Now, it's just beyond crazy that the people of the United States, who for sure, I mean, the Diamond angrily pushed this off today, but it's just a fact. If AIG had not been rescued, they'd have all been toast in September 2008. And, you know, this fortress balance sheets just won't work against a worldwide collapse. And everybody knows this. The people in the United States bailed these guys out. They did it by TARP. They did it by deposit guarantees, which were really crucial. They did it by letting the Fed and the Fed, Freddie and Fannie buy mortgage-backed securities. They did all kinds of things and huge tax concessions in the wake of that disaster, right? And, you know, then to have the banks sitting there strangling cities and school boards, it's too much. I mean, somebody on the banking committee needs to sort of wake up and do something for their constituents, not their contributors.
What would be the primary acts of economic recklessness or public damage that you would cite J.P. Morgan Chase for?
Well, careful. Easier when you don't know about the current set of trades, you don't know about the current set of trades. You don't pretend to be an expert on what's still to be revealed. We do know, Ed Cain's work in particular has established this, that all of the major U.S. banks, all the big ones, are getting funds at a premium compared to everybody else because everybody in markets thinks they have implicit government backing. That's the biggest single problem in here, that effectively you've got a class of banks that people think can't fail. And so, of course, they're much more willing to lend to them and at lower rates. I mean, if you've got too big to fail banks, then you have a problem. And the banks themselves know this. And while they say they were simply hedging, that's what J.P. Morgan said, they were pretty obviously running that hedge center as a profit center. But again, you know, the first problem we have specifically on this is we just don't know the nature of the trade. And it's ridiculous after, you know, what is it now, 6 weeks? And actually, you know, you wonder what were the Fed and the Comptroller of the Currency doing, since you could read in the Wall Street Journal some, you know, weeks before this thing hit, that the so-called London whale trader was doing something weird. And yet none of the regulators blew a whistle. That make you feel real good as you go toward the Greek election this Sunday? It doesn't make me feel very happy.
You point out that the recession that largely is attributed to the brokers on Wall Street has caused a retrenchment of what have traditionally been human services and support, that the recession is being used as a means to go back to before the New Deal, to retrench unions, to cut wages, to minimize labor, and at the same time, enhance wealth by reducing taxes upon it. And can you tell us why that opportunism against the majority of the population takes place, and why, as you indicate, that I think so many of us might know outside of places like this, that the corporate press is a part of that agenda as well?
Well, look, you know, there's two problems. One is that, if I may speak somewhat loosely but very directly, the corruption of our politics. Other is exactly what you suggest, the corruption of our media. Yeah. I mean, I was quite struck by when the little transit study appeared on the swap agreements the other week that almost no major media picked it up. Now, I have to say, you know, Gretchen Morgenson in the New York Times did pick it up. As far as I can tell, absolutely nobody else did. Now, the Boston media did not. And the Boston case is, if anything, maybe the worst of all, as you look over the 10 or 12-year record on that. I mean, you're talking here, by the end of the decade, more than $1 billion probably that's just been sort of passed over from taxpayers to banks. Yeah, look, you know, we have a problem, and yeah, it's just those two things, media and money and politics. Those are our problem, but this is becoming pathological, and of course the problem is, given that you have a sort of steep downturn that throws the rest of society, you know, back on its haunches, as it were, because it's so short of cash, everybody else is weak, and you can just, you plump stuff out, you just fill the air with the sort of misleading junk. My particular bête noire here is claims about, you know, municipal and state wages. I mean, you have some pension funds where weird stuff has gone on, and you have some crazy deals. I'm not denying that. But in general, we've got good numbers on this. Going back to the early 1990s, municipal and state pay has not grown faster. In fact, it's grown a little slower than comparable jobs in the private sector. You know, that's the stuff I document in that alternate piece, I should say, where we can't, obviously, we get into footnotes on a radio station, but that seems to be the truth of the matter. And yet, you know, you open a newspaper and you think state workers were driving the place into the poorhouse. This is crazy. I mean, really nuts.
There is another issue that has been very much a part of the argument of the Occupy movement, the 99 versus the 1%, although I think it might even be more precise or useful to refer to the 0.1 or 0.01%, that
right. Yep, you're right.
There has been a reduction of public services that have historically served the commonweal. That is to say, things like health care, things like education, things like municipal services. And I'm concerned that there is a hidden flood of a new generation, or several generations by now, of students who have been usurized, who have been taken advantage of with extraordinarily interest-gaining loans for their education, so they can no longer afford, even if they could find an adequate job, to enjoy the fruits and benefits thereof because of the oh-so-heavy repayment requirements. Can you speak to the student loans?
In fact, I think total student debt now surpassed credit card debt, and certainly growing faster. No, you're right. The problem here is multi-tiered. I mean, some of this is the way, in particular, mostly Republicans, though there's some Democrats that push this, but their main champion in the last decade was actually John Boehner himself, you know, the current Speaker of the House of Representatives. The private colleges that pushed the sort of private for-profit colleges that have pushed to make the student loan programs go to them without much check, without much checking, and also private student loan companies that actually offered the service. I mean, those folks typically charge 10 to 12% on a loan that you can get through a government program at maybe 2 or 3. And that stuff's really poisonous. It is, however, not just the only part of the problem there, but it's certainly a major chunk of it. I mean, the other big story is, of course, the withdrawal of support from public colleges. What's going on in places like California is pathological. And indeed, in most everywhere in the United States, the cutbacks are huge. So that folks have no particular hope if you're in the middle class or below it, of getting a decent college education unless you're lucky enough to find a scholarship or win the lottery. Look, this is a catastrophic situation. You pile that on top of the anemic response to joblessness there, and I couldn't agree more. This is just a cocktail, an endless sort of thing that just flows out of not one, but two or three disasters.
Our guest is Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at UMass in Boston. And Thomas, your analysis is quite trenchant. And so I will now pose you the following question with only two words: Federal Reserve.
Okay, look, the Fed has clearly defaulted on virtually all. First of all, Bernanke should never have been reappointed. I mean, the errors he made should have just disqualified him from that there. Secondly, the Fed is obviously too close to big banks, though, as you're all finding out with the J.P. Morgan Chase business, you know, the comptroller of the currency and other regulatory offices have plenty of problems too. I mean, they have a huge regulatory role there. The Fed is, you have to treat it as one more regulatory agency that has been captured. I mean, I've actually done a lot of work on this in the past. I'm not going to bore you with it. The way the Consumer Protection Agency was sort of tucked into the Fed is a kind of joke on the public. The Fed's been uninterested in consumer protection ever since it was born. It's not going to change that, especially after the first couple of years of this new agency sort of publicity inside it sort of dies away. Look, we have a serious problem. I have never forgotten in the first year, very soon after Obama took office, there were hearings on the Hill, and one of the congressmen and women asked Bernanke, maybe he could insist that the Fed, which had the power, would speed the application of the proposed consumer finance law changes that were then sort of passing through the Congress. He refused to do it. And that just amounted to saying, look, we're going to let the banks rip off the public. They've let the banks rip off the public forever. They should have questioned the swap agreements that I wrote about in AlderNet. And frankly, I'm concerned now also. I want to know how much I have observed what I think is a trend for Wall Street firms to go to governors and other responsible state officials and offering effectively to do for them what some firms did for Greece before 2008. That is to say, hey, look, you know, you got financial problems. Give us some of your entities, the stuff that you own, and maybe we'll sell it or we'll do loans for you. I think that whole business needs a very careful look. I don't know where the Fed is on this. The principal problem in getting employment right now is fiscal policy. I mean, the Congress and the president needed to agree on a very substantial fiscal package. They needed, frankly, they did a half-sized one in 2009. Lots of people have talked to you about that. I was certainly one of them that said this is about half-sized. It's too small. And in that sense, trying to blame the Fed for all of the disasters since 2010 won't work. I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around in the U.S. government, but the Fed is, the Fed's a serious problem, though the Ron Paul notion of simply abolishing it and returning to the gold standard is, frankly, ridiculous.
Well, one final question for you in the 2 or 3 minutes that we have remaining, and that is, with the electoral cycle taking place this year, do you see any meaningful difference to be made between the conventional two-party candidates?
Well, I think you'll find some differences, mostly lower down, with the conspicuous exception of the Supreme Court. I have to say that the Obama administration disappointed me over and over on economic policy, on its executive secrecy, and executive prerogative claims. You know, this business of just killing American citizens without review is just, it's atrocious. That said, you know, I have to, if you're asking my personal opinion, this is not a scholarly judgment, and I'm not trying to cut. My take is, bad as the Democrats are, the Republicans are doubtless worse. But, you know, I hear you. Our problem is not to elect Democrats in the United States to fix things. The Democratic Party needs either a complete overhaul or it's going to have to be jettisoned. We need to get money out of politics, and it's in both major parties right now.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today. We've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson of the University of Massachusetts in Boston, where he is a professor of political science as well as a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and the author of a new analysis of the economy, J.P. Morgan Chase and Related Affairs at Alternet. And thank you so much, Thomas.
Sure. Thanks. Bye-bye. It's a pleasure.
All right. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, which was produced with Thiago Brozo and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your tips, comments, queries, suggestions, and leaks with an email to theshadow@wbai.org or a letter to 5 O'Clock Shadow, WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, 10005. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Setbacks, natural factors.